Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 18th of May, as we record. This week, we are talking land, luxury, low-cost holidays, and lunar exploration. Specifically, I mean British Land, whose full-year figures were released yesterday. The question of whether shares in luxury goods companies or otherwise can be status symbols. Interim figures from EasyJet, which are out this morning. And our cover feature on investing in the space economy, an idea which has crashed to earth a little bit recently, but still has its advocates. Joining me to discuss all of this are, over the line, Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Julian Hoffman. Hi, Julian.
Hi there, Dan.
And in the studio, Hermione Taylor.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Mike Fahey.
Hey, Dan.
We're going to begin with British Land. Mark, you cover the figures this time. The headline there was the 12% or so annual valuation drop in the year to the end of March. But there was some better news on rental income and some other things to pick out there as well.
Yeah, it wasn't terribly well received by the market. The shares were down by about 5% by mid-trading. The focus obviously was on that negative revaluation, just under £1.4 billion, which sent the group into a full-year loss. But I did make the point that there's plenty of professional investors out there, not least of whom the likes of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who actually disregard those valuation effects when they're looking at a company like British Land. And when you do that, when you omit the valuation swings, the underlying profit increased by just under 7%. And that that's down to sort of like-for-like net rental growth of about 6%. And that fed through into the underlying EPS figures as well. So it wasn't all doom and gloom. I spoke to the company for quite a while, actually, and they were rather keen to point out that at long last, they're actually looking at transforming their portfolio, looking at growth areas such as life sciences and their campus accommodation as well. So, you know, you can't separate values from a company like British Land, but I think the market would do well to just look at the underlying basis of that. They've reduced their core costs quite significantly too. They're not overly encumbered by debt, and they finish with a pretty good occupancy rate too, 96.7%. And again, they're sort of targeting sectors which they say have strong occupational fundamentals. So whilst the market was disappointed, I think if you take a step back, it wasn't exactly, you know, as bad as the reported figures suggest.
It was actually surprisingly strong, wasn't it? I'm sorry to butt in, but the thing that caught my eye was that they are signing leases ahead of where the market is at the moment. And they're also moving into areas like the West End where there is a lot of scope for the kind of, you know, hipster type companies that generally don't congregate around the city. So it's a very interesting sort of story they've got to tell. But I mean, as ever with British Land, they're probably 18 months behind Land Securities when it comes to developing their portfolio in this direction. Landsec had already started that process. And really, there are two questions, really, whether it begs the future of the City of London as a commercial office space. And, you know, is the growth now in sort of the campuses that they're implying that they're going to invest in? So, you know, are they going to Oxford and Cambridge and building big greenfield sites? I mean, that's the next question, really.
You could actually, I think Mitchell Labiak made the point a while ago in a piece that Landsec are actually ahead of the curve by comparison. But who's to say that they didn't jump a bit early as well? Because I don't think that the investment outlook is settled on commercial property, even though it's generally negative at the moment. But we're not quite sure what is happening with some prime city locations as well, because people are actually returning to the office in greater numbers. So perhaps the fact that they were slightly behind the curve there might work in their benefit over the long run.
Yeah, I mean, this question of the mix is the crucial one, really, isn't it, of the mix of assets British Land obviously traditionally, as you say, focused on City of London to a higher extent, also on shopping centres, which it has been moving away from for a few years in favour of retail parks. Yeah. There's that life sciences aspect as well. Canada Water, a big project there for them. I mean, is this the correct mix? I suppose that's the big question, the unanswerable question maybe at this point. You know, they've seen the writing on the wall for some areas and are trying to move. At the same time, you know, you look at the valuation changes over the past year, even the campuses, you know, the kind of life science, that aspect of it, you know, there was a fairly decent fall there, a larger fall for those than for retail parks of about 12%, which probably speaks to the starting valuations as much as anything, but also speaks to the unknowability of you know, which of these assets is going to hold up best in a tough economic climate.
Oh, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think that the problem that British Land might face is where the unanswerable question is whether they're going to need a capital raising to progress more of these out of town type projects or these, you know, this diversified type projects. The reason why you tend to back land securities in this is that land sex is traditionally the company that goes first into cash. I mean, they did it in 2005-06 and they started again in 2020 by selling off prime assets at a higher rate than they would expect now to get for them. And it seems to me that always that if you can get in with the cash first, that's where the advantage lies. I don't know how you think about that, Mark, but
no, I mean, that's a sort of valid opinion there. I mean, I'm no clearer on it than anyone else. It's just that I still think that, you know, we're only a couple of years on from the pandemic, and then you've had a period as well. You've had a dozen successive rate rises. So I think we have to wait for the dust to clear, really, just to see what will happen with commercial real estate. If land securities has in fact gone at the right time, then, you know, that would be advantageous. But I'm just not sure.
Well, yes, in areas as well, that anyone who's got commercial property exposure is facing share price attrition, and it's going right down as far as insurance companies. I mean, they tend to be quite big portfolios as well. So, yeah, but the market doesn't think that there's a lot of immediate prospects for it. But then, you know, if it gets cheap enough, then somebody will come in and get a few bargains, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
British Land itself, not surprisingly perhaps, said that they think, you know, the bottom is quite near for commercial property as a whole. Things have been relatively stable over the last quarter. This is clearly an even more unknowable question, but is that wishful thinking at this stage, given we are still, you know, quite early in this whole process, or is it partly a factor of, you know, there's a relative lack of transactions as we are seeing in the residential market, so therefore price discovery is hard? And maybe price discovery won't happen at all. Maybe that bottom is effectively in, you know, albeit only due to a relative lack of deals taking place.
Kind of unvirtuous circle, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, doubts exist within the sector itself. The level of deal making is going to go down because of that uncertainty, and that uncertainty breeds more uncertainty. Yeah, you know, we should have this conversation in about 6 months, 12 months, 18 months from now, and I dare say things may evolve quite rapidly over that period.
It'll also come up when everybody's got a refinance in 2024. That's the other. There's a lot of property debt that's coming up for rollover, and it with the rates going up now, that'll affect the ultimate valuations of the underlying assets that underpin that. So yeah, you're right. You know, it's a year's time, we'll have a much clearer picture.
So, the implication there, this won't be the last write down that we see.
No, I don't think it will be.
Well, I'll make a note in the diary for 12 months on. But in terms of those write-downs, I mean, that is something investors can keep an eye on in the meantime, isn't it? Because British Land, like Landsec, I think they've both said now they will be net sellers throughout this year. I think they made some opportunistic acquisitions at the end of last year, the peak of the panic, if you will. But that will be a test, really, of how those deals go relative to, you know, their book valuations currently, and then should give some insight into how things are progressing.
Well, presumably they're going to get more bang for their bucks if they move out of, the central London area as well.
you know, all of this boils down to, you know, they have been trading on a big discount to NAV for a long time, really, even before the third and fourth quarter last year. That discount has been persistent. They've been trying to shift to get rid of the discount. Obviously, it's become even harder in a higher rate environment and in a situation where various parts of the commercial property complex are under pressure. What do you see in regard to that valuation question, Mark? First of all, you know, that discount, is it too big? Is there value there? How do you see it?
It comes down again to the uncertainties linked to the market they operate in. They have lost about a third of their share price value over the last year as well. So,
value trap, and I think there is.
Yeah, quite possibly on that basis.
Well, as you say, 12 months' time, we'll be back looking at British Land again. And I'm sure, no doubt, before that too. But we'll leave it there for now and move on to our next subject, which is our cover feature this week, written by Mike, on the space economy.
Yeah.
Now, I said at the beginning lunar exploration, but that was really just an attempt to have something starting with an L, because it's not just about the moon. It's about, you know, the final frontier in general.
Indeed.
Investing in space.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject, this. One that I dug into probably far, far more than I needed to for this feature. But it's the commercialization aspect is something that's really kind of kick-started in mid-2010s with change in rules by the US government, which kind of excluded or forgave liabilities for some of the launches, which made launches less risky for private companies. And it also then, there was a while where NASA had no missions planned, but it still needed to get people up to the International Space Station. So it commissioned the likes of Boeing and SpaceX to do that for them. And that kind of de-risked their plans to invest in rocket technology and particularly reusable rockets.
Obviously, this whole concept is intrinsically exciting, but like a lot of exciting investment concepts, things have gone a little bit awry over the last year and even in the last few months with a couple of high-profile failures.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's nascent. A lot of the stuff that is there to be invested in is investing in kind of nascent technology. And as with technology shares, the world over, changing interest rates means people expect more for their money more immediately. And particularly with space technology, a lot of the investments will need follow-on funding in next year or the year after. And investors seem much less reluctant to do that now. So whether it's the companies themselves looking to raise money privately or the investment trust, the ETFs and all of the investment vehicles, the thematic investment vehicles that were launched mostly in 2021 when this stuff was a lot frothier, all of those have come down quite dramatically in value.
Yeah, you mentioned those vehicles and that is the long and the short of it, really. There's the tracker funds tracking these portfolios and they're the active equivalents. The Seraphim Space Investment Trust, which I know from doing the data pages in the magazine is, you know, regularly in the bottom 10 over the last year. It shows how hard it's been hit.
Yeah, but again, that's something that is investing. Some of the trackers, I think there's, and there's also a Berman fund. The interesting thing in terms of the difference in the valuations, well, there are two. One depends on timing. The funds that launched in 2021 have done much worse than the Neuberg of Berman Fund was only launched last year when a lot of that valuation crash had already happened. But also the difference between some of the ETFs and the investment trust is partly due to the type of assets that they're invested in. And the investment trust is doing generally Series B, so still quite young companies, a lot with unproven technology. But, you know, some of the exciting, and one of the analysts said to me, you know, it's exciting for two reasons. In a time like this, do you want to invest in exciting technology, which is more high risk and therefore more prone to a crash?
I mean, that is the thing really, isn't it? But the bull case, though, for the sector, you know, can you sort of outline for these high risk areas of people who are interested in them?
Yeah, of course. So at the minute, quite a lot of the investment in the sector as a whole is either in launch companies, which are still quite risky, as we've seen with the literal crashes of SpaceX's last Starship and Virgin Orbit's going into receivership in the US. But the bulk is in the satellites. And the reason for that is largely kicked off by SpaceX. SpaceX gets a lot of credit in this market for developing the reusable rocket because it's taken the cost of putting payloads into space have just, they've really crashed. I think they're down something like, there was a City note and which said they were down something like 90% on from where they were in the 80s. It costs like hundreds of dollars per kilo now to send something up to into space compared to tens of thousands a few years ago. And because of that, the use cases for a whole variety of things then become, you know, more viable.
And as you say, satellites are a big part of that as well.
Yeah, so satellites and small sats, then the constellation of small satellites. There are a lot of companies sending these up, and there are a lot of companies that then can offer services through that, whether it's companies like Viasat that do satellite broadband, whether it's companies that have software that monitors weather systems or agriculture. And still quite a lot of the main driver is the TMT world, what satellite TV, satellite radio, and as we mentioned, satellite phones as well.
And that kind of leads on to the lower risk side of things, perhaps, as well. You know, businesses which have interests in space but are not wholly dedicated to it. But that also raises the question of, you know, why you are investing in these kind of companies too.
Some of the space funds, at the safer end of the investment scale, you have companies that invest in technologies that they say now have a link to space or have relied somewhat on the satellite technology, but you wouldn't really describe them as high-tech space companies. So one of the examples that I write about in the story is John Deere. Agriculture, you know, quite staid, big, boring machines that plow the fields across the US. But the fund manager's justification for putting that into a space fund is that they now increasingly rely on this kind of telemetry data that allows them to be automatically deployed in fields. You know, you can have driverless agricultural machines that can plow acres at a time, but also monitoring soil conditions and monitoring pesticide use so that they can farm much more efficiently and increase yields. So that is kind of the safer side. You've also got lots of the aerospace linked things like Boeing, as we've already mentioned, like Safran, the engine maker, which is making rocket engines, which then obviously is used by all the launch companies. I suppose the issue with that is then if you want to invest in space, or if you are expecting some of the returns from an industry that's predicted to grow massively over the next 20, 25 years, then how closely correlated is that to a Deere or a Boeing, which may be making money for a whole bunch of other reasons, or maybe losing money for a bunch of other reasons?
That is the question, yeah. Well, as you say, you explore this in the piece. It is our cover story this week. One thing we haven't touched on, because it's even more pie in the sky, perhaps, is the idea of space tourism. And that is very much a luxury good, needless to say. But, you know, there's potentially some aspects there of interest too.
Yeah, I think we didn't touch on it in the piece for the very good reason that overall, it is not expected to be a huge part of the space economy in the future. I mean, whether we had forecasts from B of A that space is going to be a $1 trillion market within the next 10 years. Cities also think $1 trillion, but over a much slower time frame. And when you look at space tourism, some of the more optimistic forecasts are for revenue for the industry of $3 or $4 billion. So it's a tiny proportion, but it is the thing that excites people when you see Richard Branson flying around in his plane. And funnily enough, Virgin Galactic, his vehicle, which has also been through some rough times and has required more investment, and I think the SPAC that was used to launch it on NASDAQ, as Gemma mentioned in a previous podcast here, its performance is similar to a lot of other SPACs in that it's down 80-90%. But Virgin Galactic have their first commercial flight due next month.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Space tourism obviously is a status symbol for the people lucky enough to go up there. But there are different kinds of status symbols that we've been discussing this week in print. And unsurprisingly, given our favourite topic, they are shares. Hermione, you've written about this, the idea that a share itself could be a status symbol. And this was kind of sparked initially by some comments by LVMH management the other week.
Yes, absolutely. So in the April shareholder meeting, the chief executive kind of vetoed the possibility of a stock split. And this comes in the context of a really steep share price increase over the past 10 years for LVMH. So the share price has risen from 140 euros to almost 900, which incidentally now puts the price of a single share about the same price as one of the group's luxury bags or watches. In this case, a stock split would increase the number of shares and decrease the share price by the same factor and could make them more accessible for retail investors. But in the meeting, the chief executive really shut this down, and he said that the desirability of the shares is proportional to value and that LVMH shares are also a luxury product. He isn't the only person who's kind of famously resisted a stock split for this reason. And a long time ago, Warren Buffett refused to split Class A shares, saying that if they were cheaper, he wouldn't attract as sophisticated a shareholder base.
Yeah, this is Berkshire Hathaway, obviously. I mean, that argument is a bit dubious from my point of view, saying that the correlation between wealth and knowledge isn't necessarily there for those shareholders. Yeah. But it raises some interesting questions as well about, you know, from with your economist hat on, as you tend to have, given your role in the publication. Yeah. It raises some questions of things like Veblen goods as well and things like that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to be hugely pedantic here, but in economics, we've got luxury goods, which are things that people want more of as they get richer. And then we've got Veblen goods, which is slightly different, which is a thing that people want more of when the price of the good increases, basically because it acts as a status symbol and you get bragging rights when you purchase something expensive. And I think this is the kind of effect that Arnaud was really referring to with LVMH shares. Research on this is quite limited, but Morgan Stanley actually looked at Bitcoin in 2021. This is when the price of tokens was still rising. And they found that Google search traffic actually increased hugely, and it looks as though there was maybe a kind of Veblen effect going on there. So maybe once the price hit $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000, people were attracted to Bitcoin because of the bragging rights it could give them.
Yeah, I think that kind of effectively is a momentum effect, isn't it, as well, which is, as per various of our stock screens, you know, a observable effect and one that can be put to good use in a lot of occasions. So, you know, even if people aren't thinking in that way about the share as the status symbol, it does pan out in similar ways.
Yeah.
But the other thing with stock splits, which is what this kind of stemmed from, or the refusal to do stock splits. Now, LVMH, that is in contrast to a lot of the other companies we've seen in recent years, the big successful companies, or even the last 12 months, a lot of the tech companies have been doing stock splits, you know, Amazon, Alphabet, Tesla. So the majority are very much keen for private investors to still be able to hold their shares. And that's very much in keeping with the tradition of the sector as well, you know, Apple, Microsoft, in terms of their history of share splits.
I mean, I talked about this in the article because I think they're just quite a nice example of how much of an impact stock splits do have. So since the 1980s, both companies have had multiple stock splits. So Microsoft has had 9 and Apple has had 5. Now, if my calculations are right, this means that one original Microsoft share has split to 288 shares and one Apple share would now be worth 224 shares. And this has really had a big impact in keeping the kind of price lower and more accessible than it would have been. And it means that in terms of share price, we're talking in the realm of a few $100 instead of tens of thousands.
Yeah, an accessible luxury for some people. Luxury goods as a sector, you know, is one that has been doing incredibly well recently, very much in the face of recession risks, things like that. Mike, I know you've looked at this recently and we'll be looking at it in more detail in the months ahead, but it's quite an interesting sector.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about it is obviously this year, there are a lot of people who are investing in the shares on the expectation of a China rebound and this whole idea of revenge spending. Mm. And we also had Carsten Spohr of Lufthansa recently talking about massively upgrading the amount of first and business class space in their cabins. And the interesting reason for that wasn't because there's been a return of business travel. There really hasn't. It's this whole idea of revenge spending, people spending for experiences and private wealthy people really booking their first and business class cabins.
Well, that leads us nicely on to EasyJet, whose interim figures are out today.
Seamless.
Very seamless. I'm away next week. You'll get yourself this job in a minute. Yeah, those figures, again, you know, EasyJet, this is a company that you included in the ideas section right at the turn of the year,
yep.
Which was very well timed. That's not the reason we're talking about it today, although, of course, I've dropped it in. The figures today, pretty decent again, really showing that revenge spending, that desire for holidays isn't going anywhere. What did you make of those figures?
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit of a mixed bag. You look at it at its current stage, or even these are figures to the end of March. So these are the winter figures when it's a quieter period, and the headline numbers still don't look that great. I mean, it declared a pre-tax loss of 415 million, which is only about 25% worse than last year when it was still handling a pandemic and the Omicron wave and disruption. And its revenue was up about 80%. So you would think that they would have been able to manage to reduce those losses by a greater extent. The reason they haven't, though, is because they are really gearing up for this summer, putting on more capacity. They're talking about stronger levels of bookings. They have already forecast for the current period we're in, the 3 months of June, that revenue per seat is going to be up by about 20% on last year, and that's on a flat cost basis as well. So that should have a much, much better impact on the bottom line. In terms of its balance sheet, you know, it's done a few fundraisers, so it's sat on a decent amount of cash. It's not really over-levered. They have money to invest. They also mentioned today that they're going to build a new base in Birmingham. And I think one of the appeals of EasyJet, although it's nowhere near the ruthless cost cutter that Ryanair or to an extent Wizz are, but yeah, one of the advantages is it has people in places flying from places where they want to fly from. So whether that's Gatwick rather than Stansted, whether that's, you know, I'm flying into Amsterdam and Rome and yeah, more established holiday destinations and somewhere that's 50 miles away from the city that you actually want to go to.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to pick up on as well, which is still a small but growing part of their business, is the holidays segment,
yeah.
Where they're selling that, which seems to be doing better than expected. And also linking back to luxury, I mean, I didn't quite catch all the analyst call. In fact, I tuned in right in the middle of this one. But I think what the chief exec was saying as well is that the reason that is doing quite well is because they're selling in a lot of 4- and 5-star hotels in that segment, maybe getting a bit more premium, a bit more luxury end of the market than they expected. But that certainly seems to be doing quite well.
Yeah, so EasyJet is not the first airline to do this. It's probably pretty late to the game when you've got the likes of Jet2 have been doing it for years and been doing it quite successfully. But theirs is a much more budget offer. I look and I think, well, why hasn't Ryanair done something like this? And I think there's a brand perception there where I'm not sure many people would be tremendously happy to go on a Ryanair holiday, but they would with EasyJet. Perhaps that plays into the mix and the type of holidays that they're able to sell, as you said, slightly more premium. That holidays business has done really well. It's, we're still really, I think, only in like the second proper year of it operating because of the pandemic and the disruption. They launched just before, but it didn't really do anything. And in the last 6 months, they were talking about tripling the number of customers. I think they had 600,000 customers. And the chief exec, Johan Lundgren, said that business will clear an 80 million profit this year. And it's, I think you were going to mention, its long-term target was about, or its long-term target is 100. However, that's only based on its UK business, and what it said today is that it has started to sell package holidays in Europe as well. It started in Switzerland, but analysts think that the bigger markets like France and Germany will be next as well.
Another interesting bit from the call, which kind of contradicts the earlier point in a way, but it was on business travel, and EasyJet said that their business travel is at 90%, 90, of pre-pandemic levels now, which might have something to do with what you said about, you know, flying to locations people want. I think the management was talking about trips that can't be done over Zoom, you know, trips to power plants, things like that as well. So that is something which has rebounded quite a lot and is quite a good, you know, string to their bow too.
Yeah. Again, I think it would be interesting to know what type of mix of business customers are flying in business. So that business market is recovering. Of course it is. People have to go to conferences, people have to go to events, other things. People have to go see customers where that they haven't been doing for the last couple of years. So there's always going to be a natural rebound in that. But I still think maybe even on EasyJet, there's going to be an element of people paying slightly more for a premium seat.
Yeah, absolutely. The final question, again, ending on valuation. Mm. There's a lot to be positive about in these figures, but shares haven't really moved, and they haven't really moved much for 3 or 4 months now since the huge kind of rally we saw in early January.
Yeah.
Are they very much up with events now? What's your kind of take on it?
I think there's probably a little more to go with EasyJet. I mean, the shares, the gains that they've made this year are pretty spectacular. They're up 60% since the start of the year. Wizz are exactly the same. And as you've said, they've probably not moved much in the last couple of months. There's an argument to be said that for now that they are up to speed, but it depends on how far into the future that you're looking. I looked at one of the analyst notes and EasyJet's trading off 16 times this year's earning, but this year is still a recovery year for the airline, I'd argue. Next year, they're down to 11 times, and there's quite a big uplift in earnings forecasts for next year and the following year. As more of the operations reopen, as they take in more jets and go to more destinations, I think in this sector, there's been a scaling back during the pandemic from a lot of the flag carriers, whether it's Air France KLM, who aren't flying domestically anymore. The main Italian airline, Alitalia, went bust, and that's an area Ryanair have really moved into, and I think they carry something like 20% of all Italian passenger traffic now. So I think there's, for the low-cost carriers generally, there's still a lot more to go at from a market where others maybe aren't quick enough to move back into, or don't have the resources to move back into, because still a lot of the flag carriers are carrying quite a hefty debt.
Still plenty of potential.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. But thank you very much, Mike. Thank you to Hermione. Thank you to Mark and to Julian as well. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next time with
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Another Companies and Market Show.